Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, welcome along to another episode of Writer's Routine. This is the show where we chat to an author about the intricacies and nuances of their working day to try and improve the way we handle our own creativity. Today, our guest is MJ Ford. His debut thriller, Hold My Hand, it's just been released, and we talk about whether trying to catch on to a zeitgeist is ever a good idea for a storyteller. Also, we get into the whole publication process and discuss how much say a writer really has in getting his book out there, and how keenly he plots his stories, and why he thinks that with good planning, you can never spot the seams.
When it works right, the story you end up with doesn't show the seams of that plotting method. It just reads as a good story, and my own readers will have to decide if I've succeeded in that. Just as when you watch a good movie, a good Hollywood movie, you're not thinking of the screenplay and how halfway through that screenplay there is a midpoint which the collective screenwriters decided to hit. The story to an outsider should read as though it did evolve organically.
So stay there, that's all on the way with MJ Ford on this week's Writer's Routine. Hello, yes, welcome along. It is another Writer's Routine, episode number 24. I think. Thank you for coming back, if you've been with us since the start. My name is Dan Simpson. Again, thank you so much for giving us a listen. Now, if you've never heard us before, this is dead simple. It's the show that does exactly what it says on the title. We talk about the daily life of an author to see how they organise their time and their ideas for maximum efficiency with their creativity, and hopefully that can influence and help the way we work. Oh, I've just checked. It's actually Writer's Routine episode number 25, so, you know, even more than I can keep track of. Now, if you have heard us before, thank you for coming back. Why don't you tell someone about the podcast as well? Help spread the word. Now, the easiest way to do that is to head over to the iTunes podcast store and leave us a review. You can find Writer's Routine on there. It's dead simple. Write a few nice words as well. Drop 5 stars if you can. That really helps out with the podcast chart on there, making new listeners, making struggling writers who could do with a little bit of advice from some of the most successful authors around aware of what we do. And also, speaking of charts, if we had a chart of podcast listeners, well, the ones that leave us 5 stars would shoot straight to the top. So, hey, it could be you. Have a go. Try and get to the top. You can find Writer's Routine on the iTunes podcast store. So, MJ Ford is this week's author on the show, sharing his Writer's Routine. The M stands for Michael. Not sure about what the J is, but Ford is definitely Ford. Anyway, Michael, he's been amongst words for a long time, writing all sorts. He's worked in children's fiction, that's writing to spec, and a guideline for a big publishing house. You're very much told what you're meant to do with that. We chat a little bit. He's also ghostwritten celebrity kids' books, and that fascinates me. I've never met an author who's had to work in that way before. You know, very restricted within the barriers of what a publishing house wants from the big name that they've bought in to sell books, to write for them. So we'll find out how that works, how they share ideas, and the mechanics of collaborative working like that. And now he's just published his first thriller for adults. It's called Hold My Hand, and it starts with a young boy being taken by a clown at a carnival. And then 30 years later, a similar boy's body is found. And it's kind of all about the cops who then work on the case because there's a girl who sees both events happening. And the draft title of the book was, brace yourself, Killer Clown. So that kind of sums up everything you really need to know about the direction this book is headed. Also, we'll get one writing tip that could change the way you work forever. It's a really good one today. Nice, precise advice, something you can do. It's all about a video that you can easily find on YouTube, and it may completely change the way you plot and you move your stories and your dialogue along. That's on the way in just a sec. First, let's get into today's author then, MJ Ford. And we start, as always, with what he sees around him at the place where he sits down to write.
If I'm at home, I'm looking out of the window at a field filled with sheep, the occasional cow, tractors going past, very rural location, quite relaxing. But a lot of the time I leave the house and work in the nearby town in the local library. I find it much easier to work if there's a lot of ambient noise around me. So the coffee shop's a good environment in that sense.
Why the ambient noise? Why do you think that's a quirk that you need?
Maybe it just sort of moves me into my own head a bit more. So there's not really any obvious distractions because everyone's just having their own conversations around me.
I'm kind of nerdily interested in desks as well. This is something I've developed as I've interviewed 20 or so authors doing this. When you're not out in the library working, when you're at home in your office, tell me about the desk that you're on.
Oh, it's really horrible, actually. It's one of the cheapest desks you can buy from IKEA. And my wife is always threatening to buy us a nice desk from a proper furniture shop, but I'm used to the nasty scrapes and things all over the IKEA desk by now. I know where everything is in the drawer as well, and it's one of those drawers that, you know, contains thousands of tiny objects that you wouldn't want to have to sort through and move into a new desk.
It's always, I don't want to be me, but I find that a little bit disappointing, only because when someone imagines an author, you know, you get this romantic ideal of the big oak desk, something that the president would be happy to sit on. I think we'll talk a bit more about romantic ideals in a little bit. So the show's called Writer's Routine. Let's go through yours then. Does exactly what it says on the tin. From the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed on a day when you are writing, talk to me through the whole thing. What's going on?
All right, well, I'm normally up pretty early because I've got two young kids, you know, 5:30, 6:00. Until about 9:00, they boss everything. I'm getting them ready for school, sorting out their school uniforms, etc. Once they're at school, I'll return to my desk, and I'll normally read through the chapters I've written the day before, just not so much to make changes, more to just reacquaint myself with the narrative flow, if you like. And then I always find that I work better in the morning, so I work quite intensively probably till about 1:00, pretty straight, and just get a lot of words down on paper. Not always great words. Have lunch. My son arrives back from preschool, put him down for a nap, and then in the afternoon I find that my energy kind of dips quite a lot, and I really don't have the same flow of writing at all. It kind of becomes fractured. I often kind of leave bits out, move to different parts of the book, focus on different sections. So the afternoon, I'd say, is not as productive as the morning at all.
Is that frustrating for you? The afternoon, does the kind of workhorse in you, would you like to be able to write for 8 hours straight with just that little gap in the middle with your son?
I'd love to be like Jeffrey Archer, who I think he says can write 10,000 words a day, but I think when he's mostly doing it on a beach somewhere, so I don't have quite that luxury. I mean, towards the end of the day, when my daughter arrives home from school at sort of 3:30, things unravel a lot, so by that stage, really, I'm not getting a lot of good work done at all.
Let's talk about that first 4 hours then. From about 9 to 1.
Yeah.
You say that's very productive. What does productive mean for you?
Productive for me, and this will sound terribly sort of mundane, I think, means word count. I normally have a lot of projects on at once, because I write children's fiction as well, and they all have tight deadlines, and they all have a designated word count to reach. So my writing life is based a lot around arithmetic of meeting word counts. So and now I'm good for about 1,000 words an hour when I'm writing properly. So if I write from 9 to 1 o'clock, I'd expect to get actually 4,000 to 5,000 words done. I think I said before, they're not finished words by any means, but they are moving the story on, and they are moving the chapters on, and they are getting me closer to the word count I need to reach for the novel to be completed.
You say you've got a lot of different projects on at one time. Are you focusing on, so in those 4 hours, are you splitting your time up between different projects, or do you just take on one thing at a time? That's your sole attention.
I'll focus on one project at a time. So if I have about 3 days a week when I'm writing, and I won't really mix the projects across days. So you know, one day I'll do 4,000 words of an adult novel. The next I'll do 4,000 words of a children's novel, and sometimes that's almost the whole thing. So yeah, it's I don't find it at all easy to switch between narrative voices, if you like. I happen to know someone at the publisher here at Avon, and we quite often bat ideas back and forth. He's far more commercially minded than I am, and I think the conversation started with his interest in the idea of clowns and the place that clowns hold in the nature's psyche, in society's psyche. At the time, there was a sort of zeitgeist for clowns. I think maybe it was 2 or 3 years ago now. There was a lot of teenagers going around dressed up as clowns, terrorizing people. And so that's where it came from, the idea of a clown kidnapping a child. As we move forward thinking about it, certain things happened. I think that zeitgeist had passed, and also the Stephen King book It was refilmed, and in a way that's an archetypal scary clown. So I think we both became aware that that trying to tap into that zeitgeist was we were maybe slightly behind the curve. So the book changed quite a lot, and it became more about the main character, the detective character, and her psychology. But from that initial idea, I went away and basically drew up a whole synopsis, beginning, middle and end of the book. The ending is a big twist, so I can't really go into that, but that's sort of integral really to how the story works. So drawing up that longer synopsis was a real kind of turning point, where I think we both realised that we were onto sort of quite a compelling narrative arc. So the idea started with the kidnap of a child by a clown, and it's a historical crime. It happens 30 years before the main narrative of the book begins, and trying to find a way to wrap up that story, which wasn't awfully horrific and would have made me quite uncomfortable, you know, in the writing, because I don't really want particularly to write about children being killed. Trying to find a solution for that is what generated the big twist at the end. So I don't want to ruin it, but it was such a kind of neat, fitting ending, actually, that it made sense both in terms of plotting, but also in terms of the characterization of the villain, his or her psychology, and also has quite an interesting reflection on things going on in the main detective's life as well. I'm sorry, that sounds terribly vague.
I think that was a fantastic answer, actually. I think it was almost impossible to get right. Well, how about this then? You've got your elevator pitch, as it were. Child gets kidnapped by a clown. Mm. Then you've got twist at the end. Talk to me about how you're fleshing out the middle. Then how are you plotting this? What do you see in front of you when you sit down to write?
Well, I mean, I plot in quite a deliberate way, in that I've been working in storylining and story creation for a long time, and I've come across a model which I repeatedly use because it works completely in story archetype terms. And it's a screenwriting method, actually, made popular by a guy called Blake Snyder. And it's in his book Save the Cat. And basically, it's a typical three-act structure. And it lays out beats on the hero's journey through the story from where you move into the kind of the second act, where the plot ramps up and the point of no return, to a midpoint where you normally have some form of twist, and then the end you have another kind of twist which sort of mirrors that midpoint as well and wraps up the novel. But there are lots of story beats in Blake Snyder's method, I think 15 or so, and so I plot according to those, because I know that if I can nail those beats, you know, that the things are happening at the right time, then the story can't fail on some level to be quite a compelling journey and to keep the reader interested in guessing. So that's what I do in the first instance. If I have a beginning and an end, I plot out those 15 beats and before I even start writing properly writing narrative.
So that's almost 15 stops you have to make on a journey. Is that what you're kind of saying?
That's pretty much it, and a journey which gets more exciting as it goes along as well. So it's not a kind of a uniform pacing at all. It builds in certain peaks and troughs of drama, tells you, you know, how to construct a subplot and where to introduce it in the right place so that it wraps into the main narrative.
And how much detail are you giving to these beats? So you sat down at your desk from IKEA, you've got your 15 plot points in your mind. Are they in your mind? Have you written them down?
Yeah, I've written them down, and I tend to write them on paper as well rather than on the computer, because then I can put them on post-it notes and move them around as well. And I think quite visually like that about story. And what will happen is those plot points at first, they'll be simple bullet points, really, maybe one or two sentences. This happens here. And then they gradually get more and more fleshed out. They become sort of longer and longer until I've got sort of, say, 15 paragraphs. And so at that stage, I still don't really do any real writing at that stage. I then try to think in terms of a chapter breakdown for the book as well. And flesh the story out further and further. So by the time I actually get to the stage where I want to start writing real narrative, I've probably got a storyline of 15-20% of the finished word count, so maybe as much as sort of 15,000 words just in this happens in this order, with a few scattered bits of dialogue as I think about them that might fit in certain scenes, but it's all tell, it's not show at that stage. I'm sure people will be familiar with the sort of creative writing concept of show versus tell. Telling, saying in broad terms what happens. Showing is creating narrative out of that. There obviously are writers who simply start writing and organically, maybe with a small idea of where things are going, but mostly organically let a story unfold. And I'm just not that sort of writer. Because I think of my background in sort of collaborative storytelling, I've worked in an editorial collective, and we work like a TV writers' room. So we bounce ideas around off each other to generally expand a story. And if you're in that situation, you can't really have an organic way of thinking. You have to be able to communicate on a level with the people around you in shorthand to say, this is what happens at this stage, at the midpoint of the story. This is why this is where the C story folds in. It wouldn't work if you have a solitary way of thinking, like as a lot of writers will work. So that's the genesis of it. You're right in that it's not terribly romantic. I would say, in its defence, when it works right, the story you end up with doesn't show the seams of that plotting method. You know, it just reads as a good story, and my own readers will have to decide if I've succeeded in that. Just as when you watch a good movie, a good Hollywood movie, you're not thinking of the screenplay and how halfway through that screenplay there is a midpoint which the collective screenwriters decided to hit. The story to an outsider should read as though it did evolve organically.
It's quite an analytical way of doing things. Let's talk more about analysis. This is your debut thriller for adults. Did you analyse thrillers that have gone before and think about what needed to be in this story for it to sell well? What plot points you needed to hit? Red herrings, twists, and all the like?
I wouldn't say I analysed previous books. I find that my mind does work in those terms, and I do occasionally recognise, a midpoint, for instance, or the end of Act Two in a book or a film. But most of the time, I should be emotionally involved enough in that book or film not to notice those things and just to be swept away by the story. Yes, of course, traditionally in crime stories, there are features such as red herrings, such as the damaged protagonist. These days, it's quite unusual to find one of those traditional main characters like Hercule Poirot, who really has very few personal flaws himself. I mean, these days, most protagonists are in some way weak internally, and that if that comes out in the story, and it affects it normally affects them at a crucial juncture, and it's often a weakness they later overcome as well. So yes, I'm absolutely aware of clueing, effectively dropping seeds in a story which will make sense later on, red herrings.
One last question about analysis before we get to characters. You mentioned zeitgeist earlier. There was a zeitgeist for clowns. When you thought of the idea, did you kind of think, did the dollar signs flash in front of your eyes and think, this might get an audience?
I wouldn't go as far as dollar signs. That makes me sound terribly mercenary. You want a reader to see a book and pick up the book based on either the cover or the blurb. And I think it's noticeable, actually, that there is no clown on the cover of this book, probably in recognition that maybe that zeitgeist had passed, maybe in recognition that whereas some people would be attracted by that and sort of psychologically intrigued, it might turn other people off. The novel, when we first began, I did have a working title of Killer Clown, and I think that was just perceived as maybe too unsubtle, not enough nuance.
Too gaudy, isn't it?
Yeah, and again, would probably put off as many people as it would appeal to. So, I'm always wary of zeitgeist, chasing the zeitgeist, and partly because publishing is not a quick process most of the time. A book from conception to publication, at some very, very minimum, what I expect would be 18 months. And any trend in that time, it will have passed.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Right, we'll get into today's writing tip. It's one YouTube video that could change the way that you work forever in just a sec. First, I'm doing a big social push at the moment. You might have seen this if you follow us across the internet. I don't want to kind of lift the veil on how things work or let daylight in upon podcast production magic. But basically, I've stopped being really lazy. I've pulled my finger out. And I'm doing things every single day. I'm pushing out tips, tricks, and little clips of advice from our show so far. So even if you're not listening to the show, if you finish that week's episode, you can still get some helpful words of advice from some of the most successful writers we've had on the podcast over the last few weeks. So you should get involved. Give us a follow. You can find us on Twitter. It is at WritersPods on there. It's probably the best way to get a quick reply and a nice speedy retweet if you've dished out any praise. Always take that. Also through Instagram, we're at WritersRoutine on there for nice and glossy filters of inspirational quotes. And finally, there's always the website as well. the best way to find all the old episodes of the show so far and to get all the different ways to listen to the podcast as well. And you can drop us a message online too. Head over to writersroutine.com. It's time for one writing tip that may change the way you work forever. You see, every single week on the show, we get one little snippet of advice from an author and from a friend of the show. They may really help what you're working on. It may open the doors to kind of a part of your creativity that had been locked before now. I don't know, it may be something obvious that you've never really heard before, or maybe it's something that's so obvious that you've not even thought of it before, or it's something that's just way out there on the far reaches of things that you would consider acceptable for a writer to do. You may never have even considered it. Like maybe today's, like a YouTube video.
Hi, I'm Cass Green, and the author of In a Cottage in a Wood and The Woman Next Door. And my writing tip is to get onto YouTube and check out the video clip of the two South Park writers talking about their therefore but rule, which is how to plot, making sure that between every scene, you either can place the word therefore or but. And for me, it's been tremendously useful in helping me to plot.
Now, you can get more tips and advice from Cass Green by listening to the full chat with her. It's episode 24 of the podcast. You can find that on iTunes, wherever you usually get the shows from, and you can listen to it over at writersroutine.com. So, admin done, socials pushed, tips received. Let's get back into our chat then with today's author, MJ Ford. His first thriller, Hold My Hand, it's just been published. It's all about a clown that seems to kidnap a little boy. And the girl that saw it happen, and then her investigating the case as a policewoman 30 years on. Now, in the second half, we talk about writing with famous people, working on their own children's books. Also about the publication process and how much say an author really has in what goes on. And we start with the new one, the novel, Hold My Hand, and the first time that that story crept into his mind.
At the beginning of the book, it's, I don't think I'm sort of spoiling anything to say this, a child is kidnapped. And I wanted, and it's in the 80s as well when I grew up, so to sort of reflect that, I have that protagonist from the point of view of a young girl. And I think, I mean, I try to slightly misdirect the reader into thinking that something bad is going to happen to her, and it doesn't. She witnesses the kidnapping of a little boy. That was a choice because I wanted a sort of naive style of telling that first story to sort of throw a bit of irony between the narration and the reader. But then it was actually more an idea that actually the main character 30 years later should be that little girl when she's grown up. That was where she came from. In terms of fleshing her out, I know a few police officers, and so the personality that she exhibits is something of a mixture between those people. But one of the themes of the book that kind of did become about organically is motherhood and the maternal instinct and a sort of slightly twisted, unhealthy version of that. And so I really wanted to try and build into her character some of that as well. So, it absolutely made sense that she was a woman, for instance, rather than a male detective. And a lot of the problems that she has, both very real in her life and also kind of psychologically, are to do with that maternal instinct and how she is in some ways uncomfortable with it.
How well do you know your character outside the confines of the story? For instance, if I asked you, I'm not going to, but if I asked you to write me her biography without mentioning once the story and this incident that happened when she was young, do you think you could do it?
It's funny because some writers actually follow almost like a method in terms of method acting, where they will create a biography for their character in quite granular detail before they even start, you know, what their favourite music is, what they eat for breakfast, things like that. And I'm not really like that. Of course, as you write a book, you get to know a character. You know, I'm spending, I hope this doesn't sound too naff, but I'm spending 4 or 5 hours a day in that person's company, in that person's head, seeing things through their eyes. So you get to know them more and more, and you have a kind of an idea of how they react to things because of that. if you asked me, you know, about Joe's teenage years, I don't think I'd really be able to answer straight away. But if you asked me to write a short story about it and I could engage with her on the page again and through my fingertips typing, then I would be able to do that. And I've written some short stories to sort of promote the book, which will be published in various magazines, and one of which features Joe Masters a few years before this novel. I mean, she plays a very small part, but it's nice to see her on the page again. I feel kind of happy in her company, if you like.
Can I talk to you about the whole process of publication? I know it's very tough because we're sat here in your publisher's office. So, and I don't want you to be critical at all, because that would be useless for both of us. How much say do you get with the whole thing? Do you get a say? I've never asked an author this before. No. How much say do you get with cover, with title, with publication?
With the content of the book, I have, you know, pretty much complete control. I mean, I have an editor here, and she will suggest that I make changes to it, and invariably I do, because I completely trust her judgment. It's not always completely easy, because when you've slaved away at something for a long time and send it in, you're very anxious about what someone else will think of it. So if there's any sort of even if it's quite constructive criticism coming back, the first instinct sometimes is, oh, no, I know better. But of course I don't. And I'm aware of that, because I work as an editor as well. The editor almost always knows better. And if I disagreed with my editor about something, she would completely listen the other way, and we would come to a completely happy conclusion. Most author contracts, I think, contain a clause saying that the author is allowed to sort of comment on the cover. But in practice, I don't know many authors who have ever actually changed a cover. Either asked to, or if they've asked to, succeeded. Because, of course, at that stage, a lot of work has gone into it. And normally, the people who really know about covers and how covers affect the buying market have had their input and come to this conclusion. So if I didn't like the cover, what legs would I have to stand on to really criticise it from any sort of meaningful perspective, or you know knowledgeable perspective even? Same thing goes with the blurb. I'm not a copywriter. And I completely respect those who have that job, because they do it very well. So I'm not going to ask for great changes to the blurb unless I see a typo, which is very unlikely.
Was this your title, Hold My Hand?
No, it was the publisher's title, and I actually loved it from the start. I think I loved the whole package, because I can see how it works on a kind of intellectual level, but also I can see that the book has a certain look where it sort of straddles thriller and mystery, but also women's fiction to an extent. So I can see how it has wide appeal, and I like the ambivalence of the title as well. I'm certainly a lot more comfortable with it than I was with the sort of working title we had of Killer Clown. I think it's much more sophisticated. For a long time, I worked in packaged fiction, which means that I'm writing normally to a brief, to someone else's kind of story idea. And I did that on a freelance basis for the packaging company I worked for. So I started off writing books for quite young, mainly male audience of sort of 6 to 8 year old boys on a series called Beast Quest. But then I moved on to sort of what I'd sort of consider my sweet spot, which is sort of what they call middle grade fiction, 8 to 12 year old. Mostly sort of adventure stories or mystery stories, not just for a male audience in that sense, more probably for a female audience. And I've written novels for teens as well, and I've also done some ghostwriting for separate clients. I'm not really contractually supposed to go into the details of those, though.
You mentioned that was your sweet spot, that you found it. Why do you think that is? What makes you say that?
It's an interesting age, I think, that sort of 8 to 12. Children at that stage are reading independently mostly, and they are broadening their horizons quite a lot. They have the capacity to get through quite long stories, you know, adult length novels, really. But they're also at a stage in their lives where there's still a certain suspension of disbelief. So you can explore very wide-ranging topics, and you know, fantasy, sci-fi, adventure. You can have kids doing in books what kids could never do in real life a lot of the time, quite, you know, very heroic or dangerous things. When you move out of that into sort of what they now call YA fiction, you tend to see a slip back towards sort of more realism, and I think kind of readers' minds have hardened a bit against the more incredible aspects of middle grade fiction. So that's what I mean. It's just a very impressionable age. It's a very fertile age for story, I think.
How do you tap into the voice that makes it relevant for an 8-year-old?
It's interesting. I'd say it's one of the differences between adult and children's fiction is that I'm obviously an adult. I know lots of adults. I interact with lots of adults. And so I'm writing for my peers in that sense. With children, it's very different. And I don't really know a great deal of children other than my own or my close family. And I certainly don't hang around with kids of my readership, sort of 8 to probably 13-year-olds. So when I write for that age group, often the characters are in some way every boy or every girl, in some way a cipher into which children can place themselves. I'm also very aware of the tradition of characters in novels for that age group. So my characters will often be broadly based on a mixture of kind of character archetypes that have appeared in famous children's fiction. It's a question that children's authors ask themselves a lot: is it how genuine are we being in writing these characters when really we don't know these children that well? And it's quite a difficult age to imagine yourself back at as well. I think you sort of you remember your teen years quite well because all sorts of horrible things were happening to you, but that sort of golden period, if you like, before puberty sets in is something of a mystery, I think, to me as an adult anyway.
How do you approach the language that you're writing for the kids in this story?
That's another interesting question. There are obviously things in terms of content that you can't do in children's fiction, and I think you have an inherent understanding of what those are and sort of language you can and can't use. It's mostly, I suppose, through reading other middle grade fiction that you kind of have an idea of the register of language that you should be using. I don't really think a great deal about the complexity of the language. I think because you're writing normally from a point of view and quite closely normally at that age, you're not writing from a big sort of distant authorial perspective. You just sort of gradually inhabit a kind of 10-year-old's sort of way of seeing the world, and the language flows from that. Publishers are quite keen to attach celebrities to their publishing house because, you know, there's already a guaranteed market for that person. And normally what happens is the publisher will then try and find someone if the celebrity doesn't want to write themselves or can't write themselves, which isn't always the case, the publisher will try and attach someone probably who has worked in a similar genre to have an initial meeting and just to see in the first instance how writer and name brand name get on. And at that stage there's sometimes a broad idea from the brand name, the celebrity, about what sort of book they want, and it's really a case of just sort of trying to build a relationship, seeing if you can bounce ideas off each other and you're both open to that discussion. I wouldn't really be interested in just someone telling me exactly what to write. I need to have that collaborative relationship with the celebrity.
So these are novels, they're not biography?
No, these are children's novels. So, you know, more and more these days you find that certain celebrities are producing children's books because the publisher thinks probably that they can sell quite a lot of copies.
Does it work like it is with you and I sat here right now? So maybe I would, there's a comedy sketch, I can't remember who did it, but where I would kind of read off these ideas and you would kind of pick
Mitchell
out
and Webb, isn't it, I think?
And you would kind of pick out the gold from the bile that I'm spewing.
Yeah, I mean sometimes, you know, the person I'm working with is really open to it and we have a very fruitful discussion and it's very much a 50-50. Other times it can be slightly more awkward in that you know, either the celebrity has very definite ideas and is inflexible. Other times it's I have to carry the conversation, which I'm more comfortable with. And occasionally it doesn't work. You know, I've had meetings where we've decided in the aftermath that actually it's not going to work us us having a sort of relationship around a book, and you know, we go our separate ways. They might attach a different ghostwriter, or the idea might never come to fruition. But after that, it's we have meetings anywhere, really. I've had meetings at people's houses, at the pub, in publishers' offices, wherever really the celebrity feels comfortable.
Lastly, the debut thriller for adults, it's been compared to works by Karen Slaughter, Peter James. What pressure does that mount on you moving forward?
Do you know, I'm relatively circumspect because I have been in the business a while about the things that are written on the cover. I of course want the book to be a huge success. Do comparisons like that kind of weigh it down? I don't know. I think readers are relatively sophisticated as well, again, about sort of publicity material. The truth will be in, you know, the word of mouth, to be honest, that, you know, the reviews that go online, to whether or not people think it's a good book. I certainly hope so. My family think it's wonderful, so what more can I ask?
That is it then, episode 25 of Writer's Routine almost done with. Thank you so much to Michael Ford, MJ Ford. His first book, Hold My Hand, it's out right now. You can find handy links over to it on our website. It is writersroutine.com. Also, we'll have snippets of that interview with some of the best little kernels of advice and tips that he gave you, just to keep it fresh in your mind, on all of our socials throughout the week. So make sure you give us a follow, keep track of that. We're on Twitter and Instagram. Just search for Writer's Routine on those. And if you enjoyed the show, why don't you tell someone about it? Now, you could do that in two ways. Either tell someone face to face, I guess, if you're really feeling confident that day. You can even hand out flyers in the street, maybe. Or the easiest thing to do is to tell someone that you don't know about it. It's really simple. Just find Writer's Routine on the iTunes podcast store and leave us a review. Also, some nice words on Twitter are always going to get you a quick retweet. Now, next week, a little bit of a change, right? We're speaking to someone who is a writer. He does put pen to paper or fingers to keyboard, more to the point. But he's a co-writer. He's not published his own novel yet, but he did co-write one of the biggest comedy films of last year with one of the most famous comedy writers possibly in history. You can hear from Peter Fellows, who helped create with Armando Iannucci The Death of Stalin, next week on Writer's Routine. Make sure you don't miss that. I'll see you then. Bye!
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.